Well, perhaps to focus the afternoon a little bit as we begin, we could start with some chanting. And maybe we will try the Pali version of the Divine Abidings. So page 30. So for those of you unfamiliar with Pali lettering, when a letter has a bar over the top, like in the second line, metta, that makes that A long. So if it's an ordinary A, it's metta. Long, it's metta. So the bar over the top makes the vowel long. And then when you see a dot underneath an M, like in that first line, the M becomes an ng sound, like song, lung, etc. Ekang disang. So it's not an ng sound, it's an ng. Okay? So we'll leave it at that for the time being. Nothing more stretching than that. So that, and then if you're in doubt, as I remember, just listen to the home notes and the lead voice, and that will lead you along. Okay? And so this is the same words, you know, the meaning is the same as the one we did the first thing this morning. So it's a good way to resonate that and begin the afternoon with us together.
Annamayam chaturapamanyaho basanam karomase chetasa hekam disam bharitava viharati tatadutiyam tatatatiyam tata chatutang ityo dhammado dhiriya sabati sabatataya sabhavandha lokam metta sahagatena chetasa vipalena mahagatena apamanena avere ambayapajena bharitava viharati karuna sahagatena chetasa ek disang bharitava viharati tata dutiyang tata tatiyang tata chatutang ityo dhammat tiriyang sabadi sabadataya sabhavandha lokang karuna sahagatena chetasa vipalena mahagatena appama nena averena ambaya pajena bharitava viharati mudita sahagatena chetasa hekam disa bharitava viharati tata dutiyang tata tatiyang tata chatutang ityo dhammado tiriyam sabati sabatataya sabhavandham lokam mudita sahagate chetasa vipalena mahagatena apamanena averena ambayapajena paritava viharati upekasahagatena cetasa het disambaritava viharati tatadutiya tatatiyam data chatutang iti adotiriyam sabadi sabha tatayam sabhavantang lokam upeka sahagatena cetasa vipalena mahagatena apamanena avere na avaya bhajena bharitava viharati te.
Queries lingering from this morning?
Yes.
I had a question about whether I noticed chanting in Pali, the particular melody, if you will, is, I find it pleasant, but in English less pleasant. I'm wondering if there's anything in the Vinaya or anything, any rationale to precluding melody from chanting or creativity within the in that realm.
Well, the teachings are not supposed to be sung like a song, but the recitation, you know, the chanting necessarily has some kind of melodic form. So every Buddhist country has its own melodies that grow up. So our the one that we developed in English was actually, it started off, we would just chant the Thai melodic form, so there's about five or six different notes. It's quite a much broader range.
Yo so bhagava arahaṃ sammā sambuddho.
But then over the years we found that people found it hard to stay with that, and it got kind of messy. So then and then some purists said, well, it says in the Vinaya that you're not supposed to sing, and you know, we should, and it's all kind of messy, and this is just a Thai tradition, we should just chant on one note, monotone chanting. It was so we did that for a while, but then rather than devotion, depression arose.
Yo so bhagava arahaṃ sammā sambuddho vijja.
Unfortunately, I'm not exaggerating. One note. And the monk who was leading the chanting, who was a sort of given the job or had the initiative to do this and thought this was the right thing, had an extraordinary willpower and sort of was able to stay with his one note and sort of pull us all along for a few months. But then it was one of the nuns who'd been a musician before she was ordained. After about 6 months of this, she just sort of came on her knees and said, please, can we change this? Because all of us found it pretty depressing. You know, you could say, well, it's sort of the legal way of, legally it's correct, but it's effectively it's depressing. And so then she was the one who came up with the melodic form that we have, which is a sort of compromise between the highly variegated Thai form and the monotone. So the three-note system was a compromise. There's been an appeal from the Italian Vihara to have a five-note system. Those Italians, you know. So it's finding a balance between what is naturally uplifting and beautiful and what is just overly decorated. And so if you listen to the chanting they do in Sri Lanka, I think it's very, very musical, many ways. So it varies from country to country. Also, there's part of it is the difference between chanting in English and chanting in Pali. It's rather like the difference between doing the Mass in Latin and doing the Mass in English. That many people who actually don't like, not very fond of Catholicism at all, that grew up in the Catholic Church, they have sort of uncomfortable feelings about the Church, but they definitely prefer the Mass in Latin than in English. There's a kind of quality that you can't define that comes with the repetition of syllables, say like the Pali that have been recited over literally thousands of years, 2,500 years in 100 different countries. The same voices are chanting, that you're reciting the same words and having with the same meanings, and that somehow in the repetition of those very syllables, that when you recite Namo Tassa Bhagavato, there are billions of times that has been recited before you utter it in that moment, and those same words, the same meaning, that same quality of devotion. So in some way we tap into that great current of devotion that's tied in with those particular words. And it's not as though you're saying that they're somehow magical or they have some sort of intrinsic power. I mean, there are some schools the whole esoteric school in China was built up around that, or the in the Vajrayana and in Buddhism in Tibet Shingon, I think, in Japan, they emphasize that sort of side of it. But it's, even if you can find that side in it, that's not the really important piece. And that really, it's more just the associations that has, and the very strength of just sort of sheer karmic weight behind that, and then the quality of it not being your first language. Somehow there's a way that there's an over familiarity with our own language. The associations that the words already have, they're carried with them before we picked up the chanting. So we wrestled long and hard over the words that we've used in the chanting. So even the word, you wouldn't believe the debates we had about the word Lord. In short, we went back and forth on this one. for Bhagawan. But it's because those things carry their associations with them. And they're different associations with different people. Whereas with the Pali, if it's out of your own home language, then there's it's rather like being a foreigner going to a Buddhist country. It's somehow you can get more easily to the essence of it because you're not accustomed to the form of expression. It's that you can somehow, because of a lack of conditioning around the externals, and you find yourself able to attune to the essence more easily. So that oftentimes people, even though they're, again, it's the kind of rationalist, as well, I don't want to bow to something, I don't know why I'm bowing or what I'm bowing to, I don't want to do it, which is a reasonable rationalist approach. Like, I don't want to chant anything about it if I don't know what the meaning is. I've got to know what the meaning is. If I don't know what it means, then I can't just recite it reciting like a parrot. Doesn't know the meaning of it. And then it's very interesting that even though one respects that and say, well, fair enough, it's good to know the meaning rather than just blindly reciting the syllables like nonsense syllables in a psychology test, that you get the meaning, but then the same people a few years later would say, well, it's much nicer in Pali, really, isn't it? somehow the magic, there's less of the magic in it, in the English, even though you got the meaning. So that It's a balance of having both an access to the meaning and also finding that same kind of spiritual charge to it. So oftentimes it's good just to be chanting in the English simply to get acquainted with what the content of it is, the meaning and then as you get to know what the meaning is, then when you're reciting the Pali, then the meaning is there in your consciousness, you remember, you can relate to that. But the devotional flow can come forth from the reciting the Pali. But the meaning is there, you know, this line is about this and this line is about that, and this is the abundant, exalted, immeasurable line. Yeah.
It's coming. You can turn it off when you're done.
I don't know anything about the history of the chanting, like if Buddha chanted, are chants still being developed? Were they developed in other countries? So I have no context, actually, for where these came from.
That's a good question. Well, in the Buddha's time, very few people could read. And it's debatable whether the Buddha could even read himself, because it seems that in his time, the only writing that was used was either by the Brahmin priests for their own scriptures, or in business transactions, and that the average person didn't use writing, and not many people could read. So that when it was in the Buddha's own lifetime, when it was suggested about to write the teachings down, he said no, because then the teaching within a couple of generations, if it's written down, it will become the property of those who can read, and then the other 99% of the population will not have access to it. So it was learnt by recitation. That's why you get each paragraph is verbatim, with just changing. It's metta first time, karuna second time, mudita third time, upekkha the fourth time. And you know, well, no one actually talks like that in ordinary speech, but it's represented like that in the scriptures, in the Pali scriptures, because it's a heck of a lot easier to learn something that's repetitive than is changing in the complex and involved ways all the way through. So the northern Buddhist texts, which were written in Sanskrit and Prakrit, they were written down, so that's why they're much more poetic and much more varied. You don't get the repetitiveness that you do in the southern Buddhist scriptures of Pali, and so because you don't need to have that repetitiousness. So in the Buddha's time, part of your practice as a layperson or as a monastic, if you wanted to know the teachings, you had to learn to recite them. You had to repeat them, and that repetition and the reciting would be in a chanted form. So it'd be like we would recite poetry. You learn to recite a poem in school, but there would be some kind of melodic form, rhythmic forms that will be used to remember that. So even in the Buddha's time, his own teachings were being learned and recited and remembered and passed on from teacher to pupil. That's clearly the way that they were recorded within his own lifetime. So that was just an ordinary way, just like we would write something down. That's the way you learnt it, because you remembered the words and you recited them, and then that chanting form was. It's difficult to say exactly what it would have been like, but probably the Sri Lankan or southern Indian kinds of chant. What you find in Sri Lanka nowadays is probably something close to what would have been used in the in the Buddha's time. But you know, opinions vary. So the content of some of the chants, like the one we just did, the Brahma Viharas one, that comes straight out of the Pali Canon. So that's the collection of teachings that were put together after the Buddha's passing away. So that's what we would call canonical. So that's just extracted from one particular or several particular suttas where those same words come out. Other verses that we chant are composed, like the one of the evening chanting that we did the English of. That was the Supreme Patriarch in Thailand about 150 years ago was very creative, productive fellow. He produced a lot of the what's today the current standard chanting, morning and evening chanting that he used in Thailand was composed by him. But what he did was he took particular passages from different parts of the scriptures. So like the qualities of the Buddha, Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho, he, the Blessed One, is the Noble Lord. That's repeated dozens and dozens, hundreds of times throughout the scriptures. So then he took that as the opening piece, and then he composed then the second piece. Say, if you look at page 9, I think. So, so the bottom of page 9, recollection of the Buddha, that and page 8, bottom of page 8, page 9, those words are repeated countless times throughout the scriptures. Itipiso bhagava arahang samma sambuddho vicaccharana sampanno. So, okay, he wanted a passage that was sort of standard description of the nature of the Buddha, and then so too for the Dhamma and for the Sangha. So those are canonical. Then this passage, the supreme praise of the Buddha, he composed himself. He made that up. And so then, it's beautifully done. I'm sure it's absolutely spiffy Pali. Since he was the patriarch, so he would have got that right. But it's woven together of his own poetry and his own praises of the Buddha, and then things that are spread out of the canon. And similarly with the morning chanting, if you look at page 21, then this one begins with a whole long stretch of his own verses. And then it goes into, again, extracted teachings, so that the first, all of what you see on page 21, that's all that the Sangharajas, the patriarch's verses. And then from 22 and 23, that's extracted sort of Dhamma teachings about anicca, dukkha, anatta, about unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, and not-self, and the contemplation of the five khandhas, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. So he's taken those Dhamma teachings out of the scriptures and then planted those in and then made a whole sort of liturgical form where it puts those together so it's like to make a daily contemplation. So you have, in those verses, you have both expressions of devotion to Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, and then you take some particular nuggets of the Buddha's teaching, you know, the absolutely essential contemplations about the three characteristics of existence, unsatisfactoriness, uncertainty, and not-self. And then you have reciting those as a kind of daily Dhamma reflection alongside, so you have like a wisdom teaching alongside the devotional teaching. And then the chanting is sort of, and that was just 150 years ago he put that together. So people are, you know, everything is evolving. As long as things are alive, they evolve in one way or another. I haven't seen much in the way of creativity with Pali. But, you know, just like the process of our community coming to the West and then needing to translate things into English, and then things come up that, say, wouldn't be chanted so much in Thailand. But, like this Brahma Viharas chant that we just did, they don't actually do that in Thailand very much. But one of our nuns came across this and said, "Hey, this is a really great chant, this one about the Brahma Viharas. Do they ever do that in Thailand?" "Don't think so, I never heard it." "Well, I think we ought to do it." So then she copied it out and did all the notations and passed it out to everyone. "Here, let's practice this." And so it became part of our lexicon. It came out of the canon, but it's not used much in Thailand. So just because of her inspiration, then it's sort of become normal. And similarly, in Thailand, there's a whole collection of chants that we do which are similarly Buddhist. Some of them are straight out of the canon, the Buddha's teachings, and some are more composed verses. It's called the Paritta chanting, which is done for giving blessings and healing and all that kind of thing. There's one of those that we do which is called the Mangala Sutta, which is the Buddha's teaching on the highest blessings. So if you look on page 32, so one of our monks, actually when he was living at Abhayagiri, said, "Well, I think that Mangala Sutta's got so many really good teachings in it. I think it would be a really good idea if we just had a translation of this and we did this in the morning and evening chanting. And I've done a translation." And so, "Oh, that's very interesting." And then one of the nuns who was living there, she worked out the musical notation. He had the sound that he wanted it to go by, the rhythm and the melody. Then she figured out where to put the triangles to make it happen, and then composed it up. So we're actually the only ones who do this in English at Abhayagiri. But it's totally canonical. The Mangala Sutra is like a key teaching, the highest blessings. So it just has entered the repertoire because of the inspiration of that particular monk, and then we chant it. We go, "Oh, that's great. Not sure about this line or that line, but oh, this is really lovely to have this here." So things are constantly mutating and evolving over time in that way. And so you're balancing these elements of both trying to be in accord with the tradition, but also meet the particular needs and interests of people in the present moment. There's a question there. Yeah.
Thank you. Rather than follow along when other people were chanting, I decided to just close my eyes and feel what it felt like to hear it without knowing the meaning of the words. And at least two times, maybe three times, I had to actually open my eyes to assure myself that there weren't gongs and bells. I heard a symphony in this room, and it contained just a rhythm that accompanied it in a very natural way of bells at certain times and gongs at certain times. Are chants traditionally accompanied by instruments in that way, or did I make this up in some other ear?
In China they are, in Tibet also, but never in Theravada countries. Life is full of surprises. Yeah, in China, they have a whole complex forms of accompaniment that they use with the cymbals and drums and bells that go along with the chanting, and it's much more lilting than ours. But, who knows? I mean, it's maybe those devatas that were celebrating at the Buddha's Parinibbana, they showed up for today to, "Hey, it's Ajahn Chah's birthday. Yay." They're doing a thing in Redwood City. Let's show up. I'm not entirely joking. Yeah.
Ajahn Amaro, over your 27 years as a monk, would you mind telling us a little bit about how your own devotional practice has evolved, please?
Try and give you the short version. Well, I think like many people, it was just it had no particular feeling for it. It was just a thing that the monks did, the chanting and bowing and that. It was just a thing that the monks did before the meditation. The meditation was the important thing, the serious thing. And you just sort of tolerated it, and then got that out of the way, and then you got down to business. So I didn't have much of a feeling at all for the formal devotional practice. But it more, like I was saying about, you know, sitting on endless hours of retreat, more the devotion came in form of just a readiness to commit myself to the routine and the training and the monastic life, and so that quality of faith was that readiness to stick with what I was doing, and confidence in that, even if I couldn't explain it. So that it was a devotion to the practice rather than expressions of devotion. And then also I found a bit myself a bit turned off by how people could just be so sort of gushing over the teacher and kind of making a huge deal about the teacher. And not that I disrespected Ajahn Chah, but just because there seemed to be I just didn't have that same kind of expressiveness, or it just seemed strange that people would be so kind of effusive in the way they, you know, express their devotion and that. So it was it dawned on me, I think, as time went by, that how totally valuable the monastery was as a training environment, and then B, that it didn't just happen on its own, that this environment is sustained because there's this extremely powerful, stable principle holding it together, namely Ajahn Chah, that he sort of, his own practice had helped to create that space and draw those people to him and create that field of encouragement. Therefore, I could enjoy it and appreciate it. And so then when it was more, you could see the kind of immense value of the teacher and what the gift it was that they created and brought into the world, and how much I could benefit from that, how much goodness for many, many, many beings came forth from that. Then I was like, oh, wow. Then that feeling of a real devotion started to arise up towards the teacher, and then more over the years as we did the chanting. Then, you know, but then similarly, the Buddha was a sort of remote being, sort of off in the distance somewhere, and it was this kind of abstract quality somewhere far off in the past. And then, it was years later, when you just some random day, absolutely unremarkable, doing the morning chanting or the evening chanting, and it just suddenly hits you. Oh, this is all here because of the Buddha, and he was totally enlightened. And like, you've already been a monk for like 8 years, and it's not like this is news, but it's like suddenly apropos of absolutely nothing whatsoever, it's like, oh wow, that's incredible. And then suddenly you find that in the chanting, it's like, rather than just sort of trying to keep the word, remember the words and keep the tone at the right pitch, you know, suddenly it's, you know, you find yourself really meaning it. And that's like a a very common experience in the monastic community, I think, that you tend to just not make much of the devotional side of it, but slowly over time, as you get, you know, there's such a genuine appreciation, then that the devotional qualities become more of a natural expression. And then where it locates itself more readily and more visibly is just like in the way that you relate to the teacher. Like, so like when I came to England after a couple of years in Thailand and was living with Ajahn Sumedho, then that sort of devotional practice would revolve more around being ready to pay attention to him, to Ajahn Sumedho, and to do what he asked, and to listen to his teachings, and just to enjoy being around him. And so that was like a kind of delight and an enjoyment of being close to the teacher. And just, what more could you want out of life? That kind of feeling. And so whether you call it a devotional practice, it's more like that when you are able to experience that, and then it's that I say what makes it a devotional practice would be recognizing this is the value system to trust. The grumbling mind that doesn't want to bother, doesn't want to get up in the morning, doesn't want to follow anybody else's ideas, or doesn't want to fit in, that's not the one to trust. So being that kind of readiness to give up oneself to work, what Ajahn Sumedho wants, fine. Okay. And being ready to just, if he wants me to do that, he wants me to go to California, fine. I'll do that. That kind of being ready to serve and to support, to help the teacher. So it's not just a matter of praising or giving compliments to, or you know, or material offerings at all. It's more like, as it said, the Buddha's teaching at the Parinibbana. So, you know, that the, if you really want to praise the Tathagata, you practice the Dhamma. So it's like, and I would feel that a lot, that I would really admire Ajahn Sumedho and I loved his teachings, was really inspired by that, but it would continually come back, well, if you really love Ajahn Sumedho, don't just tell him that you think he's the greatest Dhamma teacher, but actually do what he tells you. Oh, radical. So that kind of devotional practice is more exercised through like a commitment to the training.
So in that sense, do you feel like your devotional practice is still evolving?
Yeah, I think it's always that way. Even for the Buddha, you know, there's a really interesting little passage in the suttas where just after the Buddha's enlightenment, he looks around the world with his all-seeing eye, and he says, well, He says, people live unhappily who have nothing to have reverence for. Who can I pay reverence to in the world? And then he looks around the world and he can't find anyone who's more enlightened than he is. He says, oh, I'm the most enlightened being in the world, therefore I haven't got anyone to pay respects to. Oh, but I could pay respects to the Dhamma. I can respect the Dhamma. Yes, I can do that. I will look up to and I will revere the Dhamma. So there you know, have the Buddha, fully enlightened Buddha, still, you know, looking for someone to look up to. And you know, maybe it's a mythical tale, but it's certainly useful in that respect, that it points to the fact that relationship of devotion pertains, and you find more and more dimensions to it, more depth to it, you know, regardless of the degree of maturity in the practice, or how many years, or how long you've been practicing. So that I think it goes more and more towards a natural expression rather than anything planned or chosen. But it also, you find yourself more naturally expressive. It's rather, people would be surprised how, say, when how sort of great enlightened masters would be very expressive in their devotion to their own teachers. Or like one of Jack's books, he describes going to see Nisargadatta Maharaj in Bombay and then being startled that he's got a sort of picture of his guru with garlands all around it. And it's like, but I thought you were the sort of high priest of Advaita Vedanta, non-duality. Well, who's this guy in the picture? What are all these flowers doing here? You know, it's like, this looks like bhakti to me. And he says, and it was almost identical to the exchange with Master Xu Yuan and John Blofeld. It's like, you gringos, you're too much. Don't you understand anything? And that kind of expressiveness and devotion and gratitude is a natural expression that comes forth. Just like, you know, the Buddha wanting to be devoted towards the Dhamma even after his enlightenment, like something to look up to. It's just like a natural disposition of the heart to be ready to commit oneself and to let that be expressed. Yeah. Okay, so in this vein, Ajahn Chah, this is a Dhamma talk that's entitled Tucho Potila, which is the name of a monk. And he was given the title by the Buddha, Venerable Empty Scripture. And this is from a Dhamma talk of Ajahn Chah, also in this Food for the Heart book. There are two ways to support Buddhism. One is known as Amisa Puja, supporting through material offerings. These are the four supports of food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. The act of Amisa Puja supports Buddhism by giving material offerings to the Sangha of monks and nuns, enabling them to live in reasonable comfort for the practice of Dhamma. This fosters the direct realization of the Buddha's teaching, in turn bringing continued prosperity to the Buddhist religion. Buddhism can be likened to a tree. A tree has roots, a trunk, branches, twigs, and leaves. The leaves and branches depend on the roots to absorb nutriment from the soil. The words we speak are like branches and leaves, which depend on a root, the mind, to absorb nutriment and send it out to them. These limbs in turn carry the fruit as our speech and actions. Whatever state the mind is in, skillful or unskillful, it expresses that quality outwardly through our actions and speech. Therefore, the support of Buddhism through the practical application of the teachings is the most important kind of support. Okay, get that? Therefore, the support of Buddhism through the practical application of the teachings is the most important kind of support. For example, in the ceremony of taking the precepts on observance days, the teacher describes those unskillful actions that should be avoided. But if you simply go through the ceremony of taking the precepts without reflecting on their meaning, progress is difficult. You will be unable to find the true practice. The real support of Buddhism must therefore be done through Patipatti Puja, the offering of practice, cultivating true restraint, concentration, and wisdom. Then you will know what Buddhism is all about. If you don't understand through practice, you'll never know, even if you learn the whole Tipitaka. And that's when he launches into the story of Tucho Potila, who was a famous teacher at the time and was the abbot of 18 different monasteries. One day he went to pay his respects to the Buddha, and as he was paying his respects, the Buddha said, "Hello, Venerable Empty Scripture." Just like that. They conversed for a while and until it was time to go, and then as he was taking leave of the Buddha said, "Oh, leaving now, Venerable Empty Scripture." That was what the Buddha said. On arriving, "Hello, Venerable Empty Scripture." When it's time to go, "Ah, leaving now, Venerable Empty Scripture." That was the teaching the Buddha gave. Tucho Potila was puzzled. What did the Buddha... Why did the Buddha say that? What did he mean? And then he says, "It's true, actually. Venerable Empty Scripture, that's me. A monk who studies but doesn't practice." So then, as he continues to tell the story, Tucho Potila, even though he's abbot of 18 monasteries, then decides he needs to be trained. And so he he meets up with a novice, a 7-year-old novice who's an arahant. And he says, well, you know, you're an arahant and I want to learn from you. And he says, well, you're an abbot of 18 monasteries. You know, you can't be learning from me. I'm just a young novice. He says, yeah, but you're an arahant and I need to be taught. And the novice says, well, are you ready to learn from my methods of teaching? And he says, well, you know, whatever you want to teach me, however you want to teach me, that's the way I want to learn. Because I'm stuck in being an academic and I am totally lost to the path. So if you can point out the true path to me and to bring the teachings truly into practice, then please tell me. So he says, okay, put on all of your robes and start walking towards that bog and don't stop until I tell you. Now this great big kind of stinky swamp. It was just sort of at the edge of the monastery area. Okay, put on all your robes. Okay, now start walking and don't stop until I say stop. Okay, and so then Tucha Potila walks, you know, off to the edge of the clearing and into the swamp, wading into the swamp, down, 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 down. Not until his head is actually under the water, then the novice says, stop! And Tucha Potila comes out, this kind of great sort of Lord High Abbot of 18 monasteries, great scholar of the Tripitaka, and dripping with this kind of stinking goopy mud, and the novice says, okay, now we can talk. And then it carries on, and he becomes enlightened at the end of it. But he was ready to be humbled, not only to learn from a 7-year-old novice, but to get covered in, to follow orders to the point where he get covered in stinking mud from head to foot. Also in the Iti Uttaka, the Buddha says there are two kinds of offerings. This is in Iti Uttaka, Sutta number 100. Bhikkhus, there are these two kinds of giving, the giving of material things and the giving of the Dhamma. Of these two kinds of giving, this is the foremost, namely the giving of the Dhamma. There are these two kinds of sharing, two kinds of help, two kinds of offerings, the offering of material things and the offering of the Dhamma. Of these two kinds of offering, this is the foremost, namely the offering of the Dhamma. The Tathagata has made Dhamma offering, unselfish, compassionate towards all beings. Living beings revere such a one, gone beyond being, as chief of devas and humans. And then in the Majjhima Nikaya, then the Buddha says, this is in the sutta called the Heirs of the Dhamma. It says, the Buddha says to his disciples, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. Out of compassion for you, I have thought, how shall my disciples be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things? If you are my heirs in material things, not my heirs in Dhamma, you will be reproached. So this whole kind of understanding or interplay of Amisa Puja, the kind of material offering, so that the kind of offerings of food, very gratefully received by us monastics today, and the gifts of support, you know, robes and lodging and all of the support that goes into our monastery at Bhayagiri and other monasteries, all of you have given to creating this place here in Redwood City, IMC, and the hours of work. I know the first time I visited it was just after you acquired it and it looked a little less spiffy. And well cared for, and so that all of you that have given to this. That's all in the realm of Amisa Puja, that kind of offering, a material offering of our time, our energy, and the kind of material changes that we can make, helping our friends and so forth, and that. But the there's always that that element, that, and these are such powerful and useful teachings that if we want to have a the offering be most fulfilled, if we want it to really bear fruit, then it's not a matter of just transferring the object from one person to another, but there's that having things in the context of Dhamma as well, that offering Dhamma, bringing that kind of perspective of the teachings to bear as well. So that the whole realm of offering, which is sort of part of what I'd like to begin with this afternoon, it's based around the development of dana paramita, the feeling of generosity, and of the 10 paramitas, the 10 perfections. You know, dana is the sort of number one on the list, so that you can either say it's the most sort of coarse one, and that the upeka, the equanimity, the last one is the most refined, but also you could also say it's the most essential. It's the most fundamental one. And in Buddhist mythology of the last 10 lives of the Buddha, each one in the Theravada Buddhist mythology of the last 10 lives of the Bodhisattva before he was born as Siddhartha Gautama, he completed each one of the 10 perfections. And so according to the Pali mythology, so that then the 10th to last life he completed upeka, and then the 9th to last was metta, and so forth through the whole list of the 10 paramitas. And then the last three was nikamma, renunciation, then sila, virtue, and then the last one of all was dana. And so when you study the Jataka stories, you can see this depicted there. So that the last life of the Buddha was as Prince Vesantara, and perfecting the quality of generosity and giving. And so that even though there are these teachings about the difference, you know, the patipati puja, the offering of practice is the most important thing, that particular story, and many of the stories about generosity revolve very much around material, you know, offerings. And so it's good to contemplate why should just that simple act of giving, of sharing what we have, a basic form of generosity, why is that so crucial? Why is that like the final perfection, the final thing that has to be completed? And well, you can reflect about it in many different ways, but primarily what comes to my mind is that it's such a sort of basic physical gesture of going against self-concern. Is that this thing that I've got that I now give to you, or I share, that this was mine, I, me, and then given up. So it's like a very primordial gesture of unselfishness. And so in that unselfishness, that letting go of self, there's a brightening of the heart. And so that devotional practice involves a lot in the way of offering, of that readiness to give and to and in just as with the chanting, you know, we have the use of sound and the recitation of the teachings and so forth as a central piece of it. The way that offerings work is built around that basic urge to give, to share, the joyfulness that comes to our heart when we give. And one of the Ajahn Sumedho's little aphorisms that I've always found helpful is happiness is getting what you want, joy comes from giving. So you can make of that what you like, but I find that a very helpful thing. But when we are considering the whole realm of offerings, the traditional form, as you can see here, candles, these are not lit, and flowers and incense, these are the the standard way, like when you make offerings to a shrine or you make offerings to a teacher, any kind of the sort of formal gestures of giving, those are always three elements that you bring together with it. So that there's a quality of beauty in that, but also the quality of reflection insofar as the candles represent panya, wisdom, like they are an embodiment of that which brings light into the darkness, so that is that element of the threefold training. And then incense represents samadhi, concentration, just like the single point of fire on the incense represents the one-pointedness of concentration, and then the fragrance coming from the incense then pervades the whole space. So that when the mind is concentrated on a single point, then the energy is all at one point, but the effect of that is like the fragrance filling a space. And then sila is represented by the flowers. That just as a flower is naturally beautiful, that when we see a flower, it's very rare that we think, that's a really ugly flower. Almost invariably when we see a flower, there's a sense of beauty, of delicacy, of kind of natural delight when we see flowers or smell flowers. So that's taken to be a symbol of virtue. And in many of the Buddha's teachings, I think particularly in the Dhammapada, the chapter called The Flowers, there's several references there where the Buddha compares virtue to the nature of flowers, and that the fragrance of ordinary flowers always goes in the same direction as the wind. The fragrance of sila even goes against the direction of the wind. Sila ganda, the fragrance of virtue will even go against the wind. So that when we make these offerings, when say when you go to pay your respects to a teacher, or it's you're taking leave of a teacher, or even just on making offerings to a shrine, then like on an ordinary daily basis, like in our monasteries, there's always candles and flowers and incense there, and those three are the say embodying those dimensions of the threefold training. Along with shrines and Buddha rupas, then the stupas also. Where you have a relics enshrined, the remains of the Buddha or deceased enlightened being or whoever it might be for, then similarly we'd make offerings in the same way to present candles, flowers, incense. Also circumambulating, walking around three times, which again comes from the time of the Buddha as being a way of paying respect and enacting devotion. And when you go to, if you see these ancient ruins in India and look at the sculptures and that from the ancient stupa of Amaravati and Sanchi and that, they actually, even on the stupa, they have inscriptions, they have their pictures of them having their circumambulations of the stupa. There's kind of pictures of circumambulating the stupa on the outside of the stupa. Crowds of people, and it's quite marvelous because these are all carved into stone, but they're almost like bouncing off the rock. And even though it's done 2,000 years ago, these are really ancient carvings. But you can almost see, you can hear the trumpets, the bells and gongs. You can the elephants and banners and people beating drums and waving tambourines, and they're having a grand old time, rejoicing. And doing their kind of circumambulation. When we have other ceremonies during the year, then say like the Buddhist festival days, the Visakha Puja, full moon of May, which celebrates the birth, enlightenment, and parinibbana, the final passing away of the Buddha. Or Asala Puja, full moon of July, when the Buddha gave his first teaching, the turning of the wheel. or Maga Puja, the full moon of February, when there was the spontaneous gathering of 1,250 enlightened disciples, then on those nights, customarily in the Buddhist countries, there you have a circumambulation, either of the shrine or the stupa, so you, where the main meditation hall is, or if you have a stupa with relics in, then the whole community of the monastic community and lay friends and disciples will gather. And then once dark has fallen, then you you walk in procession with candles, flowers, and incense. Often this can be a little bit tricky, the wax dripping down your fingers, and because the light getting in your eyes, so you can't see where your feet is going. But you need a lot of faith element here. The saddha factor is major at that point, and is some of the most beautiful times, beautiful occasions of the year. To walk silently in the dark, and you have the full moon above, and then walking around either the perimeter of the monastery or around the stupa or around the shrine through the dark. So we had such a ceremony up at Abhayagiri in on Vesak, up in the forest at the shrine we have up there, and one of the first occasions I experienced this was a Maga Puja in Ajahn Chah's monastery, and there was 2,000 or 3,000 people came. And you know, I just got used to living with this small clutch of a couple of dozen people over at the foreigner's monastery. I'd visited Ajahn Chah's monastery once or twice, but didn't really have a sense of it. And then I was taken over there for this big festival day in February, and I was completely unprepared for this experience. It was just after dusk, and you have this, they've made this track all the way around the interior of the monastery, and literally 2,000 or 3,000 people just all in a single file, completely silent, just walking through the dark carrying these candles. So you could just see, you know, under the trees this kind of huge line, kind of people sort of the lights just gently modulating as people walked along, and completely silent. You could hear this, just the feet crunching on the occasional leaf on the ground, and just moving through the dark, and the, you know, cicadas going, and it was extraordinarily moving and powerful. And then we got to the end of it, and then everyone just placed their candles in the trees around the forest. So the whole forest was filled with these tiny little lights burning away, and it was just so rapturous and marvelous. That's such a beautiful occasion, that it's so moving. It's really, I think when my mind started moving towards thought again, all it could come up with is, I joined the right outfit. This is, of things that there are in the world, this is a good one. And just a couple of days ago, we got an email from Ajahn Pasno, my compadre, co-abbot, ensconced off in Thailand, and he was persuaded out of his cave, or his cabin now. He's been in retreat for some months now, and he was persuaded by forces beyond his beyond his power to control. Various powerful characters got him to come out and take part in a Visakha Puja ceremony in Bangkok, in the I think it was sponsored by the UN, and it was this huge event. Anyway, he and Ajahn Sumedho was there as well. And in this email, he described how it was Visakha Puja, and Ajahn Sumedho invited him to come along with him. He'd been asked to give a talk out at this monastery in Ayutthaya, Visakha. And Ayutthaya was the former capital before Bangkok. So 200 years ago, it was destroyed when they were at war with the Burmese. And there was many of the original buildings of Ayutthaya were destroyed. And this one monk had inherited a temple, and over the last 20 or 30 years, he'd been slowly excavating the ruins of the former temple that had been destroyed a couple of hundred years before, and it's completely overgrown by creepers and vines, and so he's slowly been unearthing it all, taking all the vegetation off, and and had just left the ruins as they were and had built his new monastery nearby. And he said, Ajahn Pasano is not a very hyperbolic speaker, he's very restrained. He says, I've been to a lot of ceremonies, but Ajahn Sumedho is sitting on the steps of the of this ruined Upasaka hall in the dark of the night, surrounded by 1,000 candles, and 1,000 people, lay people all dressed in white, gathered around. It was very moving. I'm getting goosebumps talking about it. So when we consider this dimension of offerings and shrines and things, it's not just a kind of dry idea. It's this kind of way that we can evoke that quality of sacredness, and that the way that we relate to a shrine. You think, oh, phew, it's just a Buddha image. Well, the one I had before was nicer, but this one's okay. Doesn't really go with the curtains, but never mind. You know. If that's the attitude that we have, then it won't have much, the shrine won't have much power to help us or to support us. But if instead we cultivate a quality of reverence and appreciation, and the way that we relate to a shrine. So one of our customs is, before even touching a Buddha image, you would make anjali to pay your respects, even before touching your own Buddha Rupa. And even in Thailand, they have this expression of that you don't actually own a Buddha image, you invite it to come and stay in your home. It's kind of presumptuous to think you could own such a thing. And so the whole way that they language it is that I would like to invite this Buddha image into my home, and so that you or someone wants to donate an image to the monastery, I would like to invite this Rupa to come and live at the Vayagiri. Which is, you may think, well, that's a bit stupid, but what it does to the heart is, it's very beautiful in terms of that respect of you can't demand that quality of wisdom, of purity, of wakefulness. You can't demand it to do anything. You can invite. you move graciously around it. You don't just sort of me grabbing it, me, the me grabbing wisdom, but sort of the me approaches with a gentleness and a respectfulness. So all these tiny little ways of relating and working with even the material objects of a shrine, they have an effect on the heart, rather than sort of going over to a Buddha and picking it up by the head and sticking it in your bag. Is that more to sort of you make anjali, and then you pick the Buddha up gently and sort of carry it in a nice way, and then that very gesture, even think, well, it's a material object. Am I being superstitious here? I mean, it's just a lump of wood, or it's a piece of rock, or this isn't even rock. This is resin. But still, life is what you make it. Yeah, things are, if we see that by using the form of that object, that even if it's a lump of resin that's been made into the form of a Buddha image, then it's our choice to then relate to that in a respectful way. It's because we are relating respectfully to that quality of our own nature that it's symbolizing. Then we experience that kind of peacefulness and beauty that comes from that. Does that make sense? Yeah, so there's a purpose behind that, and so that gesture of offering respect, offering up what we can, giving our careful attention, we see that as an enormous support. If we relate to these objects in this way, then we are much more able to relate to other people in this way, and also to our own mind in this way, rather than in a kind of clumsy or habitual, forced way. Another of the things we do, along with making offerings to support like our friends and our family or our centers, our monasteries, supporting the monastics. In Buddhist tradition, one of the things that's done quite often is making offerings to make merit. Like Ajahn Chah was saying, you know, people going around making merit and sort of there on these tours. One of the traditions, and this comes up every so often for Western people, when somebody close to them dies, and you think, well, what can I do? You know, this person has died, and I don't know what am I supposed to do? Is there something I can do in relationship to this person, or what's appropriate? And one of the things that's quite surprising to many people in the West is that, not to everyone, but to some people, is that in Buddhist tradition, when somebody dies, then one of the first responses of the family is to make offerings to the monastery. The first thing you do is to go and make offerings at the monastery to make merit, to create blessings, and then to dedicate those blessings to the person who's just passed away. And so, of course, there can be a lot of superstition about this, you know, needless to say. But it's also a very, very skillful tradition. So I thought I'll just talk about this for a little bit, and then we'll have a break for some walking meditation. And again, it varies from country to country. Now, Thailand is what I'm most familiar with, so I'll talk about that. So what happens is that when somebody dies, then the family will come into the monastery virtually immediately, because often it's the monasteries where they're being cremated, so that they come in immediately to the monastery, and they will make offerings that day, and it could be either food offerings or material things that might be useful to the monastery, and so that then they'll come in on that first day. A week later, after the cremation, then they'll come back again. The family will gather, and they'll come back again, and again they'll make offerings to the community. And then usually on the 100 days after the death, they'll come back again. Sometimes at 50 days as well, but almost always the 100th day is very important. And then after a year, then that family will come back. So you have these particular days, so after a week, after 100 days, after a year. And these punctuate the process of grieving in the family. And so the first thing, the person's died, it's a terrible shock, and there's this immediate raw sense of loss. And then a week later, there's, you know, the news is spread and everyone knows about it, and more people have been able to gather, but there's still this very strong sense of loss. And then after 100 days, 3 months or so have gone by, and that people have more got a sense of, okay, well, so-and-so is no longer with us, and the family and friends are beginning to reshape themselves given that. And then a year later, then it's not long gone, but it's a year already? And then the person in people's lives are reformed, and people still have strong feelings, you know, poignant or kind of mixed feelings about the person, but they're able to revisit that. And what happens as each time, because the act of offering and generosity is naturally joy producing, what you're doing is you're slowly wedding the feeling of loss and grief with something that is naturally brightening and joyful. So along with the grief, there is that quality of joy and the time of coming together. And so that as time goes by, then the without trying to suppress the grief or negate the feelings of loss, then the person's passing, their death, becomes an occasion for joyfulness, because the positive delightful feelings that come through from the acts of offering, that really the merit, the blessings that come from that, the good karma that comes from that giving, ripens more and more. And so it's kind of a interesting thing when in England I was living at a monastery called Amaravati, just north of London, and we have many, it's very convenient to get to, it's about 25 miles from London, so it's very easy to reach, and it's just near the sort of big beltway, motorway that goes all the way around London too, so it's very easily accessible. So you have many, many Asian families, lots of Thais, Sri Lankan families, and particularly for Sri Lankan families, they make a very firm point of coming to the monastery on the death anniversaries and of their family members. So sometimes you'll be there, and it's like six families, and it's a whole kind of buzz of energy, and there's, you know, mum and dad, you know, six sets of parents and children and grandparents and uncles and aunts and the whole gang, you know, like a, you know, 50, 80 people all sort of show up, and it's this great sort of buzz of energy, and everyone's sort of meeting each other, and then you say, well, why have you come? Oh, it's my father's death anniversary. And it's and something that was very tragic and painful, you know, 8 years before, now has been worked around so that then it's the day to remember Dad, and so it sort of replaces the birthday as being the day when you actually have sort of digested the feeling of loss and grief that's come from that. But it's more like, oh, this is one of our annual big days, and we all get together, and it's very joyful. And it's not sort of celebrating the life of as a way of suppressing and negating death, but just you've allowed that to be digested and to be taken into the whole system. Well, yeah, and then of course the teachings that are almost always given when people die are not very consoling. Buddhism is not a very consoling religion. You know, it's like we are the heirs of our karma, born of our karma, related to our karma. Well, he's gone to a better place, hasn't he? Well, maybe, maybe not. You know. Not certain. Anicca, you know. Depends on what he did with his life, you know. So it's a bit demanding. You know, Buddhism is a lot more demanding than many other religions. But it's quite wonderful to see how over time, and you know, and often, you know, the same families, you were there when they first heard about the death, or that first happened, and you know, everyone's very distraught and upset, and then just seeing how that the acts of offering and giving and coming together and making those gestures in the context of the temple, in that, you know, you're there in the holy place, and you know that you're suffering, and you know you're suffering because of attachment. That's what is the cause. This is why it's so painful. It's because I love the guy, or you know, she was my daughter, or that's why it hurts so much. But then that being within that environment of Dhamma then helps us to digest that, to acknowledge the grief and loss, and then working that in with not just commiserating or having sort of Dhamma teachings telling you to wake up and get over it, but just the sheer act of offering, that people are getting together, they're cooking up, you know, a whole pile of food from the day before and that morning, and they're all getting together, and everyone is having a gathering and then a feast, and that sense of giving to the monastery, piles of boxes of things that are useful stuff, there's a brightening quality. And so that this is not just an Asian custom, it's not confined to any kind of ethnic group at all, it's a human principle that if we if we're skillful, then we can take those principles of offering, and this is primarily using the example of death, and then creating merit, and then transferring, dedicating the merit to the deceased person. But it works with any other kind of painful experience or difficulty, that responding to it by generosity. You see what I mean? Yeah. Rather than just sort of going into the poor me and then working with the meditation to deal with the poor me feelings, actually uniting that experience with something that's intrinsically freeing. And like I said about dana, it's like it's going immediately counter to that feeling of I, that gesture of giving. It suddenly, in that moment when I'm giving to you, then I am not the center, right? And just that break, and when we're feeling a lot of suffering or grief, the mind gets so focused and tightened up on our own feelings, and just that kind of you, I'm not the whole world, and leaning out and bringing another in is a tremendously powerful way of helping to digest that reality of separation from the loved is suffering. And this has always been the deal. This is the contract we signed when we came in. That's the way it's always been. And we will be separated from those that we love. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And so then it makes us much more able to acknowledge that, know that, and not be threatened by that.